And we'll proceed to the third case, Iman versus Gonzalez. Ms. Cho.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Benita Huang Cho, and I represent the petitioner, Mr. Imam Raza. Your Honors, the regulation at 8 CFR 1245.1C8, which provides that arriving aliens, which includes paroled aliens that are in removal proceedings, are not eligible for adjustment of status is invalid because it's in direct contradiction to Section 245A of the Immigration and Nationality Act. The First Circuit in Sukar v. Ashcroft has struck down this regulation as invalid. The Ninth Circuit in Bona v. Gonzalez has struck down this regulation as invalid. The Third Circuit in Zeng v. Gonzalez has struck down the regulation as invalid.
Can I ask you just a question about the statement of facts here in your brief? Page 2 says that your client arrived in the United States on June 4th, 2002, and applied for admission to the United States using, and I'll quote, a photo-substituted passport. Year of political correctness, but what does that really mean?
So that means that he used someone else's passport and inserted his own picture in the passport.
He used a phony, fraudulent passport to get into the United States.
That's right. That's right.
And that's just, when we say photo-substituted passport, that's a way of kind of cleaning it up a little bit.
But I think that's the language that the government used in other documentation, but yes. That's what happened.
The petitioner used in this case.
Right, right.
Got it from the government, though, Judge Evans.
Judge Evans is a very straightforward judge, Ms. Chow.
I understand,
sure,
Your Honor.
Sure,
calls a spade a bloody shovel regularly.
I understand.
Well, that's the difference between judges from Chicago and judges from Milwaukee.
May I proceed? Okay. Finally, the 11th Circuit, in most recently the 11th Circuit in Scheer versus U.S. Attorney General, has found that the regulation in question is invalid and has struck down the regulation. The standard of review in this case should be de novo because we're discussing the interpretation of law. In reviewing a regulation which implements a statute, the regulation is subjected to Chevron deference. So in regards to the Chevron analysis, the first step is to determine whether or not Congress has precisely defined what is its intent. Okay. After...
You know, it's an interesting issue with the circuits kind of mostly going your way, but are any of these... circuits who recently decided this case by panels, rehearing the case en banc?
I believe it's my understanding that the Eighth Circuit that...
That was a split decision in the Eighth Circuit.
Right, right. And then the government had just last night faxed a decision that in the Fifth Circuit, I think the name of the case was... forgot the name of the case. Moman. The name of the case was Moman. In that case, the Fifth Circuit also upheld the regulation, and I believe there was not a dissent in that panel.
But are either any of these cases being reheard en banc?
Not that I'm aware of. Okay.
Just waiting for the Supreme Court to show some interest in one of these cases, isn't it?
Okay. So in regards to the Chevron analysis, the first step is to determine whether or not Congress has precisely spoken to the question at issue. If Congress's intent is clear, then that ends the analysis. Congress's intent should then be enforced. However, if the statute is silent or ambiguous in regards to the question, then you move on to the second step of the analysis, and it must be determined whether or not the regulation is a permissible construction of the statute. In Sukar, the First Circuit decided that after reviewing the plain text of the statute, the statutory scheme, and the legislative history, that congressional intent was clear that arriving aliens, including paroled aliens, they should be eligible for adjustment of status in the United States. The petitioner would urge that this court follow the reasoning in Sukar, the First Circuit. The text of the statute at Section 245A indicates that there are two main categories of aliens eligible for adjustment. The first category would be aliens who are inspected and admitted, and the second category would be aliens who are paroled into the United States. Congress explicitly defines these two categories, thus the regulation in question is contrary in the, under the plain meaning of the statute. So paroled aliens are eligible for adjustment under Section 245A of the Act, but the regulation provides that the paroled aliens are not eligible if they're in removal proceedings under the regulation in question. But Congress does not define the eligibility for adjustment just under Section 245A. Congress went further, and under Section 245C, defined eight categories of aliens that are not eligible for adjustment of status. The First Circuit in Sukar found it notable and significant that there was no specific carve-out for eligibility for adjustment for parolees and adjustment of status. Congress easily could have provided a carve-out in Section 245C that provided that parolees and removal proceedings not be eligible for adjustment, but it didn't do that. Congress did not stop with Section 245C either. Congress enacted Section 245I, which provides an exception to the exceptions. So Section 245I provides that even if aliens are ineligible for adjustment under Section 245C, under certain parameters and requirements in Section 245I, they may still be eligible to adjust status. So clearly Congress has provided a very comprehensive statutory scheme to decide who is eligible for adjustment of status. In addition to the statutory structure, legislative history shows that it was Congress's intent that paroled aliens be eligible to adjust their status in the United States. Legislative history shows that the purpose that 245 was enacted was so that aliens in the United States would not have to travel abroad to obtain their immigrant visas. The purpose of the act was to try to relieve the burden on U.S. citizen relatives of those aliens so that their spouses and whatever the relationship was, they wouldn't have to travel abroad. Finally, the act was intended so that the U.S. consulates abroad would also not be burdened by all these applicants coming to obtain their immigrant visas. Thus, Congress has spoken clearly on the issue of eligibility. They have provided an explicit, comprehensive statutory scheme to provide who is eligible for adjustment of status. Thus, the Attorney General cannot implement a regulation which contradicts the clear eligibility requirements that Congress has already put in place in the statute. Respondent would have you find that Muell is the reasoning that should be followed by this court. In Muell, the circuit found that that the regulation at hand should be upheld because the Attorney General had discretionary authority to decide whether or not adjustment should be granted. However, the court in Muell in the Eighth Circuit relied on a case called Lopez v. Davis. Lopez is easily distinguishable from the instant case because it dealt with a statute that was ambiguous and very broad. The statute in question provided relief to a broad category of prisoners for early release. This is very different from the instant case where we have Section 245 eligibility for adjustment, not in just a broad category. The Congress provided for two specific categories of aliens and then listed eight categories not eligible and then listed other requirements where even if you're not eligible, you may be eligible if you meet the requirements in Section 245I. So the instant case is very different from the case in Lopez. The court there held that where a statute is silent on eligibilities, then an agency may reasonably choose to exercise its discretion to exclude eligibility for relief to certain categories. But again, this is not the case here. In our case, the comprehensive statutory scheme provided by Congress is very clear and very specific and is not broad as it was in Lopez. Moreover, in Lopez, the categorical restriction from eligibility for the relief did not contradict the statute in question. But here, the regulation is in contradiction to the statute. The regulation provides that arriving aliens in removal proceedings are not eligible for adjustment, yet Section 245 provides that paroled aliens are eligible for adjustment. Respondent in his brief claims that Congress has never limited his discretionary authority, but this is just not the case. Every time Congress amended Section 245 and provided additional subsections of aliens not eligible for adjustment of status, the Congress further limited the Attorney General's discretion to adjudicate an application. Thus, every time the Congress said that there was a category of aliens ineligible, that took away the Attorney General's discretion to then grant eligibility in his discretion. Congress has been very active in controlling eligibility requirements for adjustment of status. This shows that it was Congress's intent for parolees and removal proceedings to be eligible to adjust status. Petitioner is not disputing that the Attorney General does have discretionary authority that was granted by Congress. However, the issue at hand is what was Congress's intent to the scope of the Attorney General's discretionary authority. Since 8 CFR 1245.1C8 contradicts the clear language and expressed intent of Section 245A of the Immigration and Nationality Act, this is not a permissible construction or a permissible exercise of the Attorney General's discretion. As such, since petitioner is a paroled alien in the United States, he should be eligible to file an application for adjustment of status and have his application adjudicated on the merits.
Well, if that were to happen, and there was no categorical prohibition on these sorts of cases, would it be a permissible basis for denying adjustment of status to somebody who entered the country with fraudulent?
Yes, that may be a permissible discretionary decision.
Okay.
If there are no more questions, I have nothing further.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Jones.
Thank you.
Mr. Gorsuch?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Neil Gorsuch on behalf of the government. Judge Bauer, to answer your question, not only was there document fraud committed in the entry, but there was document fraud committed in the asylum application as well. The immigration judge, 3 years after entry, held an extensive hearing, a 100-page record, an 18-page written opinion from an immigration judge documenting additional fraud in three documents presented by the alien. So there was enormous process given to this alien who arrived. He received an immigration officer hearing, 3 years' worth of delays, a transfer, a massive hearing, and then, after he was found deportable, 3 months later, gets married and then seeks change of status on that basis. So just so the record on the facts are clear, Your Honor, this case presents an interesting question of law. And, in fact, there are two premises that petitioner depends upon. The first premise is that 1255 grants most parolees the right to file a change of status application. That's premise number one of their syllogism. Premise number two is 1225 prohibits most parolees from getting a change of status application because of the high standard. I think both of those premises are fallacious. Let me address the first one first. The language of 1255A couldn't have been clearer. It says the Attorney General may, in his discretion and under such regulations as he may prescribe, prohibit parolees from filing change of status applications. Each of those three things is important. The notion, First Circuit, that the Attorney General is prohibited from issuing regulations is defied by the plain language of the statute itself, which contemplates regulations. Your Honor, if there are any questions about the language, let's look at precedent. There's a great learned hand opinion quoted in Yang, INS versus Yang, which uses the great old language of what does discretion mean? It means grace. It's in the Attorney General's grace. And that has been the traditional understanding under the immigration laws since time immemorial. INS versus Yang itself uses similar language, saying that discretion means that it imposes no limits on the factors the Attorney General may consider. Lopez rejected a similar case-by-case approach advocated by petitioner involving firearms by nonviolent offenders. Now, the only answer the First Circuit has to Lopez is to say, well, there isn't a carve-out similar to 1255C, where in 1255C, as Your Honors are aware, there are certain categories that Congresses never get eligibility for change of status. The answer to that, however, is in the language of the statute before Lopez itself, which said only nonviolent offenders may get a reduction in their sentence if they go through a substance abuse program. It, by its plain language, precluded violent offenders from getting that same credit. So Congress in that statute clearly restricted eligibility, but nonetheless, the Supreme Court found that the Attorney General, and they're the Bureau of Prisons, I'm sorry, was free to issue regulations further limiting the scope of those nonviolent offenders who would be eligible for the reduction in sentence. There, the Bureau of Prisons regulation said it can't involve anyone who was using, carrying, or possessing a firearm, even if he's a nonviolent offender. An absolute categorical rule. And Justice Ginsburg said, if we reached any other result, if we required a case-by-case analysis, it would create favoritism, disunity, and inconsistency. Exactly the same could be said here, Your Honors. Finally, I'd like to point two other cases to you. First, the Richmond case in this circuit, Your Honors, quoted at page 13 of our brief, which says expressly that the power to deny on a case-by-case basis implies the right to set categorical rules for all cases. That's binding precedent here, Your Honor. And then finally, Judge Friendly, in a 1970 opinion on this statute, in Phuc Hong Mok, I hope I've got that right, said as follows, and forgive me for quoting, but Judge Friendly usually gets it right. Having expressed its judgment that two categories should be ineligible for the exercise of discretion, and there Judge Friendly was referring to alien crewmen, the 1255C exceptions that are now eight categories that are absolutely precluded from change of status applications. Back then it was two. He's saying, having expressed its judgment that two categories should be ineligible for the exercise of discretion, Congress left it open to the Attorney General to determine whether the applications of all other aliens seeking status adjustment under Section 245A, our statute, should be evaluated on the merits of each case, or whether some categories were susceptible to handling on a less individualized basis. So there's the precedent, Your Honor. I might point out even the 11th Circuit and the 3rd Circuit have agreed this ain't a Chevron Step 1 case. They've gone to Chevron Step 2.
Judge Becker says it's a Chevron Step 2, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, sir, he does. That's absolutely correct. And so does the 11th Circuit and Schur. Now, the only other hook they've got, because they don't have precedent, they don't have the plain language, is a legislative history. And they like to make a lot of the fact that the 1960 legislative history said that we don't want parolees to have to go back home to file change of status applications. That's absolutely correct. But that has no bearing on the question whether the Attorney General can limit the number of parolees here from seeking change of status. It simply says why they passed the statute was to avoid having to go back home. It doesn't guarantee anybody, let alone most parolees, the right to file change of status applications. Nothing in it. To the contrary, the more recent legislative history in ARERA, 1996, made clear Congress's intention to restrict and streamline the parole process. And that's what Attorney General Reno was trying to do when she issued this regulation. And this case, I dwelt on the facts at the outset of the case for a moment, is a classic example of why Janet Reno, as Attorney General, issued this regulation. Because of the massive investment of resources that the government is spending adjudicating these appeals, 3 years worth of proceedings, opinions, and two appeals before you get a change of status application, and then we're supposed to start all over? That's what the Attorney General is trying to deal with. So that's premise number one, that the Attorney General can't exclude most parolees as a matter of discretion, but that's not permitted to him because of 1225. I'd like to now deal with the second premise, which is that, as the First Circuit says, most parolees will, as a practical matter, be denied the opportunity to file change of status applications. I don't think that assertion is justified in the record or in the law. In the first place, the First Circuit concedes that under 1225B2A, some parolees will be able to file change of status applications because B2A contemplates that aliens who are not clearly and beyond a doubt entitled to be admitted shouldn't be admitted, but those who are clearly and beyond a doubt entitled shall be allowed to file change of status applications. So under 1225B2A itself, First Circuit must concede that some aliens, some parolees, can file change of status applications, those who meet a very high standard, to be sure. So that's point one. Point two, the First Circuit and the 11th Circuit failed to deal with the fact, nowhere mentioned the fact, that the Attorney General has prosecutorial discretion in these cases. He doesn't have to bring removal proceedings against every alien parolee. And there's no basis for believing that he does willy-nilly bring enforcement actions, removal actions, against every parolee. Your Honors, in fact, 8 U.S.C. 1252G expressly recognizes the Attorney General's discretion and makes judicially unreviewable his discretion whether to bring removal actions. It's codified in the law. And, Your Honor, Attorney General Reno, when she adopted this regulation, specifically mentioned that fact in the Federal Register. And it's on page 17 of our brief. Quote, if the service decides as a matter of prosecutorial discretion not to initiate removal proceedings but to parole the alien, the alien will be able to apply for adjustment of status before the district director. She contemplated the use of prosecutorial discretion. Third, Your Honor, precedent. Again, Reno versus American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee interpreted 1252G as rejected a selective enforcement claim by an immigrant, finding that 1252G gives the Attorney General absolute discretion in deciding whether to initiate proceedings. Johns versus DOJ, Fifth Circuit case cited in our brief, found that the shall deported language of 1227, like the shall remove language in the statute here, is purely discretionary and that there is prosecutorial discretion. Town of Castle Rock and the Supreme Court involved a mandatory arrest statute that cited Johns with favor. And of course, we've got old Heckler versus Cheney, which made clear that prosecutorial discretion resides even in statutes that say the agency shall initiate proceedings. So there is no basis for the First Circuit assumption or premise that most parolees will be in removal proceedings given, as a matter of law, the Attorney General's discretion. And there are no facts either. This is another just striking thing, Your Honor. As petitioner points out and concedes and makes an affirmative point, there is no fact in this record as to whether most, some, all, none parolees are in removal proceedings. She concedes that point. And by conceding that point, I think hurts the cause of the petitioner. And that the same facts existed in both the Muell case in the Eighth Circuit and the Moman case in the Fifth Circuit, which we cited to the court. In both those cases, the Court of Appeals recognized the absence of evidence as to how many parolees are or are not in removal proceedings to be dispositive. In fact, Your Honor, the two data points you have run against petitioner's position. First, in Muell, the Eighth Circuit took judicial notice of the fact that DHS statistics reveal that only 2-3% of parolees are in removal proceedings, showing the Attorney General's exercising his discretion enormously. The Eighth Circuit took notice. And second, as Moman noted in a footnote, in every case, except for, Your Honors, this one, concededly, and Sukar itself, the alien parolee was in this country for a considerable period of time, able to file adjustments, status adjustment claims, for a considerable period of time before removal proceedings took place. And just to tick them off, Your Honor, in Bona, the Ninth Circuit, the parolee was in the country for 8 years before removal proceedings were instituted, 8 years' worth of opportunity to file a change of status adjustment. In Geish from the Eighth Circuit, the parolee was in this country for 7 years, able to file change of status applications before removal proceedings were initiated. Zhang, the Third Circuit case, 6 years. And Muell itself, 10 months. So the evidence that is available to you that you can take notice of, both from Wells' citation of the DHS statistics and from the facts of the cases themselves summarized in the Moment footnote 8, clearly run contrary to any assertion that most parolees are, in fact, in removal proceedings. Your Honor, if there are no further questions, I'll conclude with one final notation. As you're well aware, there is a deep circuit split, 4 cases one way to the other. The Solicitor General obviously is considering this issue. In addition, there's also contemplation possibly of resolving this by regulation. I don't know the details of that, but I did in candor want to alert the court that that is something the government is being has under consideration.
But you have no timeline that you're ready to offer us.
Your Honor, that's above my pay grade.
I understand.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks, Court. Ms. Cho.
Your Honors, just again to address the issue regarding the document fraud, in this case, that should not be relevant. The issue at hand is whether or not the regulation is valid. The issue at hand is whether or not petitioner is eligible as an arriving alien to at least apply for the application for adjustment of status. So the issue of document fraud would be decided after he's permitted to apply for adjustment of status. It should be noted that he would also be eligible for a fraud waiver because he's married to a U.S. citizen. If his U.S. citizen spouse shows that she will suffer extreme hardship, he would be eligible still to adjust status with a fraud waiver. The Attorney General's reasoning that it's reasonable for them to implement this the regulation because of their intent to want to try to expedite proceedings may be reasonable, but it's not consistent with congressional intent. So whatever the basis for the Attorney General's implementation of the regulation still has to be consistent with whatever the congressional intent is in vis-a-vis Section 245A of the Immigration and Nationality Act. Respondent argues that the majority of parolees will not be placed in removal proceedings, but again, as stated in Section 1225B2A, when an arriving alien is at a port of entry, if the alien cannot prove clearly and beyond a doubt that he's entitled to be admitted, he shall be put in removal proceedings. So the statutory scheme does indicate that the majority of arriving aliens will be placed in removal proceedings. But in any event, the number of parolees is not determinative of congressional intent. One must look at Congress's intent for the statute, the language of the statute, and the legislative history to determine if the regulation is a permissible construction of the statute. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed to